Welcome to the Midsters Podcast, your podcast for inspiration on being bold and saying yes to making the most out of your midlife.
So, Marianne, good morning.
Morning.
And good morning to our special guest today, Paige Alexander, who is the CEO of the Carter Center in Atlanta. Welcome, Paige.
Thank you. I'm honored to be here. I feel like I'm sitting around the kitchen table talking to y'all. So thank you.
Thank you for being here.
We're so excited to have you. And for our listeners out there, among other things, besides being a fantastic human being, very dedicated to her career, a fantastic mother of three really successful adult children, Paige was also recently named in Forbes 50 over 50 list. So 50 influential women over the age of 50. And so we think she is the perfect example of what midlife can be.
Thank you. Thank you for that. It was definitely getting named in that and having them put my age up front was a realization that, you know, I'm glad I'm still in my 50s, but not for much longer.
So, Paige, one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you today, and you and I have a long history together. We've been friends for 30 years. So I have seen the course of your career. I have seen how you've raised your children. And quite frankly, you fascinate me because you are someone who somehow seems to effortlessly balance both your career and the demands of motherhood. And I kind of wanted to start with the career end because I also know from having watched you that your career has had an upward trajectory, but it hasn't always been steady because there's been times where you've switched positions because you were phased out of different jobs for political reasons or just changing, you know, the direction or focus. And even for a while you lived abroad. So I guess my first question is how did you sustain that upward trajectory of your career through all these twists and turns?
Well, I would probably start by pushing back on the effortlessly. I think that even if it appeared to you above the water, it was effortless. Underneath the water, I was certainly paddling around. You know, raising kids is tough, and especially back when we were raising them and you didn't have the ability to bring them into work or work from home, those were not things that you were able to do. So it was always, for me, a balancing act of making sure the kids were happy and making sure I was showing up at work. So being able to show up for both of those spaces. So I'm glad that it appeared effortless. It definitely was not. I think you'll remember in elementary school, I always wanted to be the room parent, and one of the moms, who's actually the wife of a cabinet secretary, when I came in one day with, you know, homemade things back in the day when you can homemade things to bring them into the class, she's like, "You're making us all look bad. Like, you're working full time and you're still doing this, and we're all going to the grocery store and buying things." And for me, it was trying to achieve and show up in both places. And it took me a while to realize that actually I just couldn't be everything to everyone, but it hasn't stopped me from trying. And as far as the sustaining the momentum at work, so much of that is due in part to having a really, you know, perfect spouse and a cooperative partner and kids who understand the importance, because we talk about it at the dinner table, of foreign policy. I mean, my poor kids knew more about the Houthis in Yemen than like most Americans knew, because it was important to me that they understood why I was working so hard on certain areas. And I didn't have to worry about, you know, my jobs. I was very fortunate. They came and went, but I did everything kind of in 9-year increments. And so I haven't had that many jobs. And I was determined early on that I liked public service and I wanted to work in public service and I wanted to work in the nonprofit field. I wanted to do international development work. And all of those things allowed me to really focus on what it was I wanted to do. So the noise of private sector, going back to school for an advanced degree, those things didn't really enter my trajectory because every job I had brought me to the next job. And so I was fortunate that way.
When did you know that that was what you wanted to do, that public service, and particularly your work has all been in international development realm, that that was your calling?
Part of it was ruling out certain things along the way. You know, straight out of college, I went into a political campaign and absolutely loved it. It was a presidential campaign and we lost, but I learned a lot of lessons there and made a lot of friends. And one of the lessons I learned was I had a boyfriend and I followed him overseas. And fortunately, he's now the father of our kids. So that worked well. But I fell in love with the fact that other cultures were going through changes. In this case, it was Czechoslovakia back in 1990. And to be part of, on the front leading edge of a society that was going through changes and thinking I had something to offer was very empowering. And so, you know, not the white saviorism complex that I think, you know, international development sometimes has. It was just being part of a community and living in a community and feeling, what could I do to help further this? How could I be part of it? So I fell in love with the international side. And then when I came back to the U.S. and realized policies really mattered, it was nice to be able to get into the public service side of that, where I had something to say and to add to the policy discussion because I had lived it. I had not just studied it in a book. I had actually lived it overseas. And that constantly sort of reinvigorated me to think, I know what I'm talking about because I've been there, I've seen it, I've lived it. And that was empowering. And that's why I stayed on that trajectory.
I love the fact that your passion and your drive comes from, it sounds like, a very innate place on loving people and wanting to better their lives. That connection that's outside of your realm here in the United States, right?
Right. But it also is based on, you know, growing up here in Atlanta, Georgia. My parents moved here during the civil rights movement. They came from Boston. My mom came from Boston. My dad was an Army brat. They wanted to be part of something that was bigger than themselves. And so they became very active. So whereas my kids know all about the Houthis from the dining room table, I knew all about civil rights from growing up here in Atlanta. I mean, Andy Young and Maynard Jackson and John Lewis were, you know, family guests of ours, and not dining room table guests, but, you know, breakfast room table guests. They were the people that my parents were friends with. And that spurred on an interest in that type of policy and public service and an interest in recognizing, you know, between different communities, what's important to them.
So would you measure your success? Let me see how I can articulate this. I think I know the answer. It sounds like you feel your success through what changes you make for others and not so much of your own career path and where you have found yourself. When you're evaluating your entire career, I think of success and mastery a little bit different. And I just feel for what you're saying and the passions, I can see it in your eyes. I mean, you're very passionate about what you do, and it's more because of what you're leaving behind versus your own staircase that you're going up.
Well, look, we did not grow up knowing we were privileged. I mean, that was not a word that people used. It was not a statement that people made. But I knew I had everything I needed and everything I wanted. And I was very fortunate. But I didn't realize I was privileged until I started seeing and spending time in other communities that made me, you know, really question if I were in Azerbaijan or in Nagorno-Karabakh, and I came back to my house in Arlington, Virginia, and walked into a walk-in closet that I knew three people lived in a closet that size in, you know, an internally displaced camp I'd just been in. It was crushing for me to sort of see that juxtaposition. And so, yes, I think my success is that being able to elevate voices that otherwise are not heard. And I think here at the Carter Center, I have the ability to do that because we watched President Jimmy Carter and Rosalynn Carter do that. And, you know, they used to say their faith demanded they do all they can for however long they can, wherever they can. And I think that that's something that we as humans should adhere to, whether it's faith or whether it's just recognition that it's important to give back.
Right. It comes from gratitude.
Yeah, it does.
And I think because of that, I mean, I think that it was interesting you said earlier that the trajectory of your career kind of took care of itself because every job sort of led to the next job. Yeah. But I will say I suspect maybe that's because you were focused on ultimately the good that you were doing and the mission of the jobs that you had. And it was less about I have to attain a specific level. That enabled the jobs to kind of roll one to the next.
Absolutely. And I would say this is one of my guiding principles. It's never about me. It shouldn't be about you. It should be about the work that you are doing and the people that are being touched by the work you are doing. You know, titles are wonderful. And in Washington, they mean so much. And that's one of the reasons why when we left DC in early 2017, it was one to prioritize our son who wanted to, you know, pursue his dream and play soccer overseas. It was also because my husband made me realize that titles have become so important that when you lose it, you then feel that you're at a loss. And he said, that shouldn't be how we act. We shouldn't be worried about what table we're invited to sit at. We shouldn't be worried about what talk we're able to give. And so rewiring for those 3 years we were in the Netherlands was really important because people weren't on their phone on the weekends. There was nothing in my office that was important after 5 o'clock any night of the week. And you know, you could work from home. I had never even heard of work from home. And, you know, I worked from home 3 days a week. And I just, it was a balance that Europeans seem to have that especially Washingtonians did not have or I had not had. And so that was important. And now in this part of our lives, you start to realize y'all had a whole episode on harmony. You know, what is harmony? At what point do you find that balance? And for me, that balance had been controlling situations. Mm. And now that balance feels more about empowering others to control a situation. So it's just, it's different points in life. But my jobs have probably because it wasn't about me and people recognize that. And that's how you get elevated. I was happy to take notes. I was happy to get the coffee. I was happy to do anything. And that put me in the room at important times and left me to listen to those around me. And I didn't come in with an agenda. I came in to learn. And I think that helps propel you in your career.
What are your biggest challenges right now in the space that you sit in at the Carter Institute? Carter Center, I think.
I think it is the external factors right now that are the biggest challenges. I mean, there's always going to be labor issues and bureaucracy. I mean, we've got 300 people in Atlanta and 3,500 people overseas. It's a big center. But when external foundational changes happen, like we are seeing now, and funders pull back because they're not able to be, you know, they can't share their philanthropic goals as easily as they used to be able to because they don't know about uncertainties. Those are the external factors that you have to mitigate for. But for me, I don't think we have the luxury to wait. I think meeting the moment and acting is where we are at the Carter Center now and trying to figure out what can we do in this moment to address these challenges. And that should be how life is lived.
Mm-hmm. True. Have there been any experiences in your past that are helping you now be able to navigate that big situation?
Sure, being a mom. I mean, there's no question. And my
helps everything, Paige.
It is, you know, dealing with colleagues, dealing with family, it's very similar. And I think that sort of perspective helps a lot. And
right.
Having the challenges, you know, I started as a desk officer at USAID, you know, like I knew what it was to be a desk officer and I knew what it was to be a Senate confirmed person. And I knew the roles in between. And having that appreciation for everybody else's position is probably the most important thing. Just as a mom has to appreciate that gut-wrenching change of, you know, somebody not being able, you know, a child not being able to play sports when they're passionate about it because they injured themselves, that in their perspective in that moment, it is the most important thing. Mm-hmm. And you have to have that empathy to understand it, to be able to work with it. And so that's the, in a work environment and a home environment, I think they're very similar.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I want to go back to something you said a minute ago, going back to the home environment, about talking to your kids around the table about what you did. And I, that really sort of struck me because I think that's really important. And a lot of women miss that. When we're in home mode, we're in home mode. And when we're at work mode, we're at work mode. And there's sort of a feeling that we have to really bifurcate those parts of our lives. But I love the idea of making sure that your conversation as a family makes it very clear to your children, not just what you're doing and what your purpose is, your professional life and what you're working on and why it's important. I suppose also for your husband, Steve, would have been sharing the same thing. And it kind of makes the whole family invested in you as much as you're invested in them. And I think that's really important role modeling for how to live a balanced family life.
Is that the environment you grew up in, Paige? From what I understand, your mother was an activist. So is that some modeling that you had learned growing up?
Absolutely. There's a family story. So my dad was a lawyer, intellectual property lawyer. And so he went to the office. My mom was a community activist and worked on campaigns and raised four kids. But my mom cut out an article that was in the New York Times. This was back in the 60s. That said, families that have dinner together are stronger and the kids do better in school. And so she left that for my dad. And so my dad made it a priority to be home for dinner. And sometimes it was later, but he was always home. We always had a family dinner. And I have three older brothers. And so getting the word in edgewise, I would say was difficult. But obviously, I was the girl and I could talk, you know, to a brick wall. So it was probably them getting the word in edgewise. But we would always go around the table and talk about what we had done that day. And so to get my kids to do that, so we always prioritize family dinners as well. And I would ask all three kids, I'd say, tell me three things you did today. And, you know, I get grunts out of the boy and, you know, and the girls would, you know, always had stories. And one day they turned around on me and said, what are three things you did today? And I thought, you know what? I think they're ready to hear what I do. And it was a turning point because it did then became a family conversation. And I think that that's what family dinners, to be honest, were kind of about for me growing up. And that's what I wanted to make them about for our kids.
I love that.
And Leslie, I did learn a lot from you because you are always very honest with Harry. Sometimes I would say to a fault, but you taught me it's like if you treat the kids like they are ready to hear the truth, then quite often they're more resilient in the long run because you haven't covered them in bubble wrap and had them live in a life that had nothing negative to it. So,
well, thank you for that. I think your kids also had the benefit of being very well traveled because you're very well traveled. You lived in, as you said, you lived in Prague early on in your adult life, and then you lived in the Netherlands. But you've also seen a whole lot of the world. What do you think you've taken away from that? And also, what do you think your kids have taken away from traveling along with you that's affected how you view your life?
It's a great question because I don't think I fully understood the effect of it until Josh, our youngest, our son, wrote an essay and he talked about the importance of like when we went to Kenya and we were in Nairobi, we dedicated a day to going to a slum area called Carolina and Kibera. And it was a UNC project that had been done in the slums of Kibera. And we brought things with us and the kids had raised money at school and it was them giving back. And I didn't realize, you know, and now we were just Rachel, our oldest, was at State Department. She was posted at the U.S. Embassy in Bangkok, and we all went to visit. And we were in Cambodia, and we spent the day at the Genocide Museum. That's our family trip. Like, we always go to places that give you the history. We were with Josh in Argentina. He was studying there and went to Chile and saw the Pinochet Museum and the memorial in both Chile and Argentina. Like, that is part of the history of the country that you're in. And the fact that they're interested in that and they realize that builds into the experience we're having, even in Belize, you know, it is, those are things that they want to go places that are not just laying on a beach somewhere. I want to lay on the beach during vacation, personally, but they always have different ideas. And I get a lot of energy from the fact that they see the world as bigger than, you know, just the city that they're living in.
Well, you know, you're showing them the suffering. And I think a lot of parents protect their kids from human suffering, and they're seeing it front and center. And I think there's a lot there, and they'll probably do incredible things because that moves you in a way that if you don't see that, it's not touched, not in the same way.
Yeah. And the funny story, because Carly, our middle daughter, she was in charge of one of the days in Cambodia, and our older daughter said, what are we going to do after we see the Genocide Museum? And Carly Googles, what do you do after spending the day at the Genocide Museum? AI came back and said, you go get massages and ice cream. I was like, I think we have a very well-balanced sense of like how we experience things, because we were totally overwhelmed. And, you know, the feeling, that's not a plan. We need a better plan. After we got out of it, we were like, that's exactly what we need to do. We just need to sit with this information. And we have the privilege to.
ChatGPT to the rescue.
Oh, man. It was very, that was one of my earlier experiences of seeing how ChatGPT could like help in everyday life.
Yeah. You know, we're real big on travel, and Marianne and I talk about that a lot. And we actually travel together a lot because we, and you and I have traveled together, but we travel together for photography. And I think what resonates with me about what you're saying is we always say, when you go to a place, try to experience it in a real way. If you're there just to see the top 10 sites on Instagram so you can take a selfie and post it, you're missing a lot. Talk to people. Go out and see the things that locals go and see. You know, be present in the place. But now I think I'm going to add to that list, make sure you're picking up a little bit of the history of the place, because that's actually very important.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that you don't know what you're seeing if you don't know where they came from. Yeah. And it's, you know, it feels a little less true in the United States. I mean, you don't need to go to every presidential center to understand things. But when you do come to one, suddenly it piques your interest that, yes, we did have this issue back in the day. And yes, we did overcome this problem. And this is how this person handled it. Or this is what our country went through at the time. And, you know, we do fourth grade, you know, state history, and you have to do American history to graduate. But, you know, even here at the Carter Center, I am constantly amazed at what I find out, you know, my former boss did. And I feel that way about the Reagan Library, you know, everything there. These people were real, and the history of this country is real, and they were based on real decisions that were made at a time. And that's how we became who we are now.
Let me ask you one more question. In the course of either your professional life or your home life or both, how did your relationships with other women affect how you proceeded? Like, what I'm thinking on the professional side is, I mean, you're a little younger than me, but, you know, we both kind of came up in a time when there wasn't really a strong network for women. I'm wondering if that impeded you, or if you built your own network, or how, you know, connections with women may have helped you there. But then also in the home front, we had a very active moms group. And how did that impact how you viewed your life as a parent?
Yeah, you know, I think it does go back to how I was raised. I have three older brothers. And so I was the only girl in the family. And, you know, my parents would spoil me and my brothers would knock me back down to size. So I had a balance there. I also knew how to interact with men in a way that it was not, I just knew how to do it because, again, three brothers. And so when I ended up in the work setting, I was fine back in the day if I was considered the one who was going to be taking the notes or the one who was getting the coffee. I was fine because I also knew how to listen, how to ingratiate myself into circles that I wouldn't be seen as obtrusive, but I was learning. And then I became the reliable one, just as I think I'm the reliable sister. And so I created that within a work setting. Within the personal setting, sometimes it was more difficult because I didn't have a sister. So I didn't know how to have those female interactions in a way that could be thoughtful and help me grow versus like bringing people with me, but not necessarily assuming that those women were going to be the ones who helped. And so I think, you know, much to the my comment about being part of the mommy mafia, you know, trying to overcompensate and be the mom at school who did everything, I thought that's what was expected of me. And I didn't realize I was actually bringing the angst of other moms on me. And so backing off was something that might, you know, taking my foot off the pedal there was important. So I learned from other moms that in helping raise kids. And in the work setting, it just, it was never a hindrance for me. I always thought it was helpful to be, I was used to being the only woman in the room and I didn't have a problem with that. And I could play the role. Women code switch all the time. I mean, we're much better at that in many ways. And from the South, being, you know, young from the South and being a woman in public service, all were things that were differentiators. And I saw them as positives, not negatives back in the day.
You should know, and you probably do know this, that in the reverse situation, you were really quite an inspiration. And I will never forget the day, I think it was maybe second grade, I think Lindsay and Carly were in the same class, and you came in and you had made cake pops for the treat for one of the, and I was so, I was so in awe of you because I knew that you worked and I knew that you, you know, had a very demanding job and I had never even heard of cake pops and they were delicious and they were homemade. And I was really blown away by that. So you have inspired me and I'm sure you have inspired many of the other women who know you to, you know, take on challenges with your characteristic grace and smile and happy demeanor and can-do attitude. So I appreciate that about you.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it is. I'm pretty competitive when the kids say they like something. I then, of course, I'm like, I can do this. You should have seen me in Amsterdam trying to make Chick-fil-A nuggets for Dosh. Like, I was like, apparently you brine the chicken. Like, that's the whole thing. Like, and so it became, if the kids said they like something, I was like, well, I have to figure out how to make it. So thank you. And you have photography, Marion, you've got, you know, music and photography and y'all walk and you exercise. Like me in the kitchen, that is my Zen place. And so being able to conquer something that someone likes or wants is reassuring that I can do it and I'm fulfilling what somebody else is interested in having. So it's, but yeah, I miss making cake pops. I should go back to doing that.
It's been interesting talking to you. I appreciate you being here, Paige.
Yeah,
thank you. I appreciate your interest in this. And thanks for your conversations. I mean, you give your discussion on harmony and travel. And, you know, those are things that we at this point in our life all need to figure out what's grounding for us. And your podcast does that for me. So thank you.
Oh, thank you. Before we sign off, I'm going to see if Elizabeth has any questions that she would like to put forward.
I do have one question for you. You've been a part of a generation of women who pushed into spaces where few women had been before. For women in midlife who may feel the weight of expectations or the pressure to keep proving themselves, what advice would you give to them?
I think once you hit midlife, you have to arrive at your own professional maturity and recognize that you need to be happy in what you're doing, because that is the vibe that the younger generation will see. And if you are, if you find comfort in where you are, you know, that that should be, that is the message we need to be sending to other women. You know, I had, there were plenty of women who had broken glass ceilings before me. And so I might have been of the generation that was coming up after that, but I saw how they did, and it was hard-edged and it was hard-nosed. They had to do it to break that ceiling. I could be softer, but now you don't want the next generation to be so soft, but you want them to see what power looks like. And power looks like harmony and comfort and balance. And when you exude that, it helps others see that there is that possibility. Because I worry that somehow the pendulum is swinging back and the younger generation feels they have to go in hard edge to make things happen. They have to be the only voice at the table or the loudest voice at the table. And I want to show people that's not necessarily how you get to the next ring on the ladder.
That's really great. Thank you so much. We really have enjoyed this conversation.
We have. Thank you, Paige.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Y'all should come down to Atlanta and visit.
Well, you know what?
I love that.